Okay, we'll bring the meeting to order here, and so this is a joint committee hearing to get some more discussion around the genetic information report that came out and some legislation that arose out of it, fair to say, I think. And so how we're going to proceed today is we're going to have a kind of overview of the report by Ms. Byer Kropensky, and then walk through the various bills, which my understanding is one is kind of the majority report and one is more reflective of the minority report. Is that however it is? We'll just lay those out, and then have some public testimony as much as we can get through by the time we're going to wrap up here. And so let's start out. Welcome to the committee. Just identify yourself for the record, if you could.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Lori Barkowski with the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration was given the task of convening a work group on genetic information in Minnesota, which we submitted to the legislature in January. And as you can see, the legislative charge for this group included a variety of things. And what I've highlighted here on this slide is you will see the references to which of the bills addresses which of the recommendations. So I'm not going to cover all of the recommendations, but just generally touch on the ones that are in both of these bills. And both of the bills address an ongoing concern of, we did a report even 2 years before this that had some language, and it became placed in Chapter 13, which is the Data Practices Act. So for the last 2-3 years, we've all been trying to figure out who does this language apply to and what does it do. So that is, I think, the nature of the dispute, is some folks are very clear about what the Minnesota's current law is, and many others are like, we don't know what it means. So I will go through that a little bit more detail as we go forward.
And that's 13.386.
Yes, okay. 386. And for those of you, hopefully, understand that Chapter 13 applies to government entities in Minnesota and really regulates data, so records and information, and it doesn't regulate property, so things like an actual biological specimen. So for data practices, aficionados, it's a huge distinction. Now, the work group that the legislature wanted us, the Commissioner of Administration, to convene was one that was not naturally intended to reach any kind of consensus. If you see the number of stakeholders that were included, it was really meant to be able to fully flesh out the issues so that you would have the widest variety of spectrum of decisions and viewpoints. And that's, of course, what the report in the end does, is you don't see a lot of consensus, but you do see a thorough analysis of the different perspectives. We met over 18 months and had a number of recommendations. Currently in Minnesota law, there have already been some protections for genetic information, both in the health and life insurance area, as well as in employment. And that third bullet, 13386, is where really all of the kind of the debate and the controversy has really centered. I also just want to add that the Federal Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, the federal law, provided some protections. Minnesota pretty much already had these in place, so GINA is not that new for Minnesota. Now, as I mentioned, Representative Kahn's bill adopts the recommendations on the cancer surveillance system. It really just had some antiquated language that allowed a doctor to provide consent to someone being able to contact the relatives of a cancer patient. It was just really kind of old-fashioned language that really we wanted the patient to be in control of those kinds of things. And then the second recommendation is when the patient can't consent, who then, who is the hierarchy of people you would go to get permission to talk to those relatives? The Representative Kahn's bill incorporates this legislative language from the report. The third set of recommendations about access by relatives to three-generation pedigrees, and that'll be the new word you learn of the day. And if you see this little picture on the bottom, if I go into my doctor and give them all kinds of a description, kind of a family tree of disease, in my family, I might mention lots of names. And in data practices terms, I give all this information and I list a lot of people. And if that's held by government, I can't get it all back because it's all data about all these other people I've mentioned. So what we want to do is be able to make it really simple. If I provide all this information about my relatives for my care, I should be able to get that all back. So it's part of my, my file, if you want to think of it in that way. And that we also, when people go to private medical providers versus public ones, so if I go to the county nurse versus my private Allina clinic, that my kind of data and the access to it should be the same. So it shouldn't make a difference if I go to HCMC. If I have this kind of a picture graph, I should be able to get back what I said to the doctor. Does that make sense for folks? It's the hardest area in data practices, so if it doesn't make sense, I can explain it 10 other times, and it might make more sense.
So in the private area, Allina would give you access to this.
Yes.
But HCMC, there's a confusion right now as to whether they could or could not.
They probably, what HCMC would do is redact all the names except for mine.
Okay.
And they give you back the form, and they say, we know you said all this, but the fact that your dad had cancer, that's data about him, so he can come in and get it, but you can't have it back. So it's a...
Representative Holbert.
But I think for clarification purposes, if you as a patient, when you go in, and if you don't just blankly sign their consent form, I don't think that unless you give consent, they, if they're a private entity, that they can distribute it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, what happens is you can only consent to the data that's about you, and the data that's not about you, someone else would have to consent to. So if I talk about my dad, then he would have to be the one who allows that data to be shared. So it makes data practices sharing very complicated when you've got 20 people listed.
Right, but I think there's nuances to it that are important, that even in the private sector, there has to be consent by an individual for disclosure.
So just to clarify, this is not, this change that Representative Kahn is proposing in her bill is not saying it can go from the provider to some third party. That would have to have the consent of the actual person. That's what you're saying, Representative Holbert. But the person that gives the information can get it back themselves.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, what it means is I'm the person who gave it. I'm the patient. I will consent to who else it goes to. So I get to control the entire record as well as get it back myself.
President Holbert, you...
Well, I just wanted to clarify that the statement you made about Allina being able to do what they want isn't exactly correct, in that a patient in a private sector setting has to consent to distribution and use of their information.
Okay. I was thinking the other piece of it, but that's fair. But they can, in Allina, they can consent to disclosing that history about, if I were to do this graph and consent to its disclosure to another provider, they could give the whole picture. Or is that not right? That is right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Member Jeff.
Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you just maybe clarified. So just to be clear, so I have a patient who has a strong family history of breast cancer, and she wants to be tested. She wants to be tested for the breast cancer gene. So that information, that history, is okay to be sent on to the genetic testing center, wherever we send that patient. We can send all that history with her if she gives permission.
Ms. Kopinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruth, generally speaking, the patient controls those kinds of things.
Okay.
So whoever that patient is.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more question of clarification. So as you talk about going forward, if I am the patient and I go in and I tell my family history, when I ask for my record back, that family history is going to come back to me with, in its totality, as I told the story. Is that another way to understand that?
Representative, yes, that's true.
Okay.
It's the way that it operates in the private sector now, and we want to be able to say that there should be equity between a government provider and a private provider in like how we treat a patient and their information. Next off, Representative Kahn's bill also adopts these provisions related to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension about who gets access to a DNA profile, both victim and alleged offender.
And I don't think we're going to, in this committee, we're not going to go into the, what you're going to fix, folks on the health stuff. So, but thank you.
Yep.
Because I understand this was already presented to you. Not yet. No, it wasn't. Well, why don't we run through that quickly then? Yep.
Mr. Chair and members, the Civil Justice Committee had a briefing on the full report and all of the recommendations as well as these. So I don't know if you'd like to, for your members, just highlight them a little bit more.
Okay. Yes, please.
Okay. If I could figure out how to go back. Mr. Chair and members, what this provides is that when there is a DNA profile, the crime victim can have access to their own profile because it is data about them. So we just want to make it clear that when I'm a sex assault victim and they do a DNA profile on me, that I can go to the DCA and get a copy of that DNA profile. And that I can also have access to the report. So there's the extensive profile of me. There's also a report that the BCA would do that says, Lori's a match with this sample, or, you know, kind of the perp and this sample matches. Yes or no, 100% accuracy, or whatever it is, the percentage they give. So there's a shorthand version of that that a victim can also have access to as well. But that we then also, for victims are not going to be able to have access to human biological specimens unless of themselves or the perpetrator without a court order. So we really make it clear that you can have data that's about you, but if you really want a slice of the sample, either of your own or the perpetrator's, that you're going to need a court order to get that. And that's really how the BCA operates now, and I think they have not seen any difficulty with the language of the work group's recommendations. And what we finish off with is then the difference in Representative Emmerich and Representative Hahn's bills. They both do the same thing with this disagreement on Minnesota's 13.386. In Representative Hahn's bill, what she does is moves it into Chapter 144 that makes it really clear that it's going to apply to both private medical providers as well as government medical providers. Representative Emmer's bill does it a little bit differently, makes some tweaks in the language of Chapter 13, but then also places the same language in 144. So I think they wind up having the same outcome.
So just to clarify that, Representative Khan is just taking 13.386, the language that currently exists, and putting that into 144 as well. And Representative Emmer adds the piece about human, what is the word? I can't remember what the word is.
Human biological specimen, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
And that is the one difference in Representative Emmer's one bill is that one of the things the group could not come to consensus on is that larger question of who owns the sample that anyone gives up. And Representative Emmer's bill makes it clear that the person who gives the sample is the person who has the property and ownership rights of it. There is not a great deal of case law in this area, but for the most part, people have either seen it as it's, you know, kind of, if I go in to have a tumor removed, it's kind of garbage, for lack of a better word. I've kind of abandoned it, or I've gifted it to someone. Very few have said that I continue to own it if I just kind of give it up.
Representative Khan.
Actually, Mr. Chairman and Lori, there has been some U.S. Supreme Court or federal case law on it, which has to do with a very important set of cells called the HeLa cells, which are the basic cells that are used for all human, it's probably changed by now, but when I was in graduate school, that was the basic cells that were used for all human cellular studies. And HeLa, it turns out, means Helen Lane. And it turns out Helen Lane had no, it was taken from a tumor from her. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a subsequent case of someone in California who, when cells were taken from a tumor and then became highly profitable for a company, he tried to claim ownership of that, and he was denied. It actually seemed to me he shouldn't get. The argument that was made was that the whole profitability of those cells were not when he had them in his tumor, it was when the company that worked out all the stuff that was done to them. And I always thought it was a slightly, just looking at this, nothing except the end decision, I always thought that he shouldn't get the full benefit of everything that was done to it, but it seemed to me that he did deserve some part of it. But the court, and I don't know if it went up, it might have even gone up to the U.S. Supreme Court, said that no, he had no claim to any of it. So that has been adjudicated at some point.
And Mr. Chair, members, and I think many governments and researchers really kind of believe more in that. I, me the researcher, me the clinic, when you leave it behind with me, you kind of own it. I think that's generally speaking the government viewpoint.
But Mr. Chair, and representative and to the witness, you were talking about the financial reward that came out of it, and I think that's what it addressed as opposed to the what we're trying to focus on right now, which is the ownership of the actual material.
Well, I, in this case, and again, I don't it was a case quite a while ago, and I'm not sure of all the nuances of it, but specifically the financial reward resulted in saying that the person had no ownership of the cell when it was. I mean, I was just correcting the sense that there had never been a court case. I was just correcting the issue that there was never a court case on this issue. It certainly was kind of a related issue. So,
okay. So just to back up a little, so there is consensus that the 13.386 should also show up in 144 in some form or another.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know that you could go as far as say the members had consensus on that. They agreed that the legislature should really clarify what it meant by passing that language and who it should apply to. I think that there was a great deal of disagreement, and you may hear from testifiers who just think it shouldn't apply to private medical providers, or it should provide, you know, it should apply to everyone or no one. I think you'll see a lot of disagreement around that.
What does it mean to move it to 144? And anybody can answer that, but yeah, Ms. Kupin.
The biggest difference is when you look at Chapter 13, it applies to government, state and local and county government in Minnesota school districts. It, unless you have a contract, it wouldn't necessarily include a private vendor. But if you are in 144, it will include all of the different people who are required to be licensed and fit the definition of a medical provider in Minnesota. So that would be your Allina nurse, your Aspen. I mean, it would include both a healthcare provider who is funded by government as well as one in the private sector. So I think that is the biggest difference. It'll apply to your dentist, where it wouldn't if it's in Chapter 13.
Representative Holder.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Ms. Byer-Chirpinski, given that virtually every medical provider in the state takes public money in the case of health care money, et cetera, are virtually all of them covered by the fact that it's in 13.86?
Mr. Chair and members, I think there's money that flows not necessarily with a contract. So I think there's some of those issues. And are they providing a service for government, on behalf of government, or how it works? I don't think that's as clean as you'd want it to be.
President Khan.
And Mr. Chairman, just to make it completely clear, is that 1821 repeals 13.386. Mm-hmm. And the rule that became contentious that was based on that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, that's all I have unless there are additional questions.
What about recommendation 3? If you could just talk a little bit more about that again on human biological specimens. So that's not covered under, or at least a question of whether that's covered under current law?
Mr. Chair and members, I think the viewpoint from at least my office in interpreting Chapter 13 is that it can only regulate data, that it can't regulate specimens like and property like this.
Okay. Any other questions for this witness? And I know that one other bill that we should keep in mind, it fits within some of your recommendations, is Representative Rood has a bill on private genetic testing companies that we probably won't get into today, but there's also some, you know, this rolls out into that area as well.
And Mr. Chair, members, I just mentioned that a private lab similar to what Representative Rood had wouldn't be a medical provider under 144, so they wouldn't be encompassed in either of these bills.
Representative Emmer.
Yeah, I do have one more question. You had said the work group had trouble around the concept of figuring out who owns the genetic information. Can you be more detailed? What's the problem with that?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Emmer, I think that people wanted to provide as many safeguards as possible I think the ownership issue of just saying that you categorically own something and have all control over it was just very uncomfortable from government, knowing that you will pass laws saying that certain things are going to have to go to, you have mandatory disclosures right now, that it was easier to put up a whole constraints of rights and protections than to address the ownership issue. Maybe it was just a cop-out, that it's easier to just say, here's our whole system of protecting things without saying either way who owns it, yes or no.
The only problem, I mean, I appreciate your saying that it might have been a cop-out, if I understood that right.
And remember, Mr. Pence is just reporting on the Westwood Group.
Yeah, I understand. I hope it doesn't sound like I'm trying to be critical. But when I went through the report, it was very interesting to me that in the legislation that we voted on and created, and I guess I didn't notice it when we did it, the charge was to set up a work group that involved everybody but private citizens, it looked like. I didn't see, you know, there are insurance companies, there are government representatives. I went down the whole list, and I didn't see any just private citizens who might have an interest in this very issue. And did I misunderstand that? Or
no, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, there were a number of citizens that were involved. They were, I think we had spots for 2 to 3 public members, which we did have.
All right, so then following up on that, Mr. Chair,
Representative,
did they have the same concerns, or is that where the disagreement came, or the confusion, whatever you want to characterize it as?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't think that, I mean, all of the citizens were, you know, kind of their own unique perspective. I think that there were maybe half of them, 1 to 2 of them, that might have shared that same similar concern about ownership. I don't think it wasn't all the citizens. This was a discussion we had in a small group, and not all of the members participated in it, since we didn't come out with a recommendation for the whole group.
Okay.
So I don't know that every citizen had an opportunity to weigh in on that topic, but it was one that we really struggled to find some kind of a recommendation we could come up with and just weren't able to.
And just so I'm clear, and I'll be done, yep. I understand I'm just asking for the witnesses' observation. I mean, it's not, other people may have a different perspective, but as far as this working group and this specific issue on ownership of genetic material, was the conflict, and maybe that's too strong, but it's the disagreement or the inability to come to a consensus based on the right of government and private entities to do things with that information after they get it without repercussion or I'm not picking my words very well. Do you understand what I'm trying to ask? I mean, was that the tension, is that those that end up with this genetic material don't want to have to go through a bunch of hoops to be able to use it for something else or dispose of it, that sort of thing, versus the individual's right to control it?
Ms. Krupinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I'm not quite sure how to answer that, because I think that people felt strongly about ownership for a variety of reasons, and I think government and many of the other members were just uncomfortable with what it might mean. So if you are a county prosecutor and they say the DNA sample collected from a felon is owned by the felon, what does that really mean? Can he really say, I'm sorry, I don't want to be in the database so that you can catch me the next time? I think it just made people, the possibility of unintended consequences with that was just something that really, you know, people had a great deal of discomfort around. And so that's why I think the whole group just couldn't come to anything where everyone's concerns were addressed, that they could come up with a recommendation. It was, we really worked hard to try and get them to reach something around this issue. They just weren't able to. I think that everyone really tried very hard at that.
Okay. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it? I don't see on the schedule, is it your intent to have the Department of Health testify at all?
People have questions. They certainly, they're here.
I do have questions for them, and I think that it's important for people to know that the current standard in law is for consent, and this working group did not recommend to undo that. Is that correct?
Mr. Pinky.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's an accurate assessment.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me just point out, the thrust of 1821, the thrust of that bill, was to take the report, which had specific legislative recommendations, and then to ask Lori and her folks to draft. I don't know who did the actual drafting of the bill, but 1821 has the legislative recommendations that were in the majority report of the genetics working group. But it will also point out that the group had other recommendations, and a few of these were calling for more educational resources, listing of the options for secondary use of biological specimens, and then the needs more discussion of secondary uses of genetic information. And this means a use other than the one for which the information was collected. And there are some easily understood prohibitions, like the one that already fall under non-discrimination legislation, like insurance and employment, now state and federal law. But one of the most interesting unaddressed issues is the potential secondary use of the convicted offender database owned by the BCA. By the way, we're getting a huge database now, which we haven't talked about at all, the federal database of everyone who's in the armed forces. That's a whole other database if you're worrying about who has what databases. And that's where, when a DNA search is used to locate, so for secondary use, could be that you do a DNA search to locate an unknown criminal who may be a close relative of a convicted offender already in the database. And the report, apparently the only state, this is an issue that the legislature might want to look at, and the only state that specifically has a position on this is Maryland, which prohibits it. So again, it's something where you see, you get the sense of how's the best way you can do criminal apprehension, but the question is that if you look at any kind of uninformed consent for search, if you take DNA for a relative is taken, and then that leads to you, I mean, that's, it's one of the few pieces of evidence where the data on the person, as you get to this whole concept of the three-generation category, gives you data on a whole lot of other people. It may be good for society or bad for society, but it's not clear how it fits in with amendments about unreasonable searches and seizures. And if I can just say one other thing, just so legislators can be aware of this, the original bill, which covered the data, where we passed the original bill, the language was in 144. The reviser just decided to change the coding, and something I never knew could happen, but it's something to be aware of. Bill passed, signed by the governor, and the reviser, as they're coding it, just changed the coding, which did this thing, which turned out to be a problem, let's just say a problem rather than a major thing. So just something new that it took me 30 plus years of being in the legislature to learn to happen for you people who haven't been there so long to know that's something.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that what this highlights is there are a lot of other recommendations in the report that didn't have legislative changes around them, but that there will continue to be issues around genetic privacy and balancing that you are all going to have to struggle with as we go forward.
Thank you. Any other questions for the witness? Okay, thank you for coming today and for your work on this. Why don't we walk through the three bills just briefly, have the authors just do that if we could, and then to give us a sense, and then we'll move to public testimony.
And Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
At some point, I would like the Department of Health, I have questions related to their letter and the report.
And we'll do that. I want to make sure that we get to some of the other witnesses as well, though. Representative Kahn, do you want to have we gone through most of what
I think so.
Okay.
Think
Representative
so.
Emmer, do you want to talk a little
my
bit about
my bill was really just their recommendation, so I think it was a better way to get it.
Okay.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I don't know that the two that I offered require much explanation because we talked about them on the House floor. I think it's important to clarify. We, and when I say we, primarily you and I, narrowed this down to one issue that's very important to all of us, and that's the issue of newborn screening. But it's really not just about newborn screening, which is why I want to thank you for having this hearing. It's way beyond that. And these two bills arise out of, I mean, you've heard testimony, this human biological information or specimens, and basically what it did is it's just trying to clarify some of those issues that the working group, as I understand it, struggled with, primarily over who owns the material. And for me, it's as simple as, and I understand everybody wants to debate, you know, these unintended consequences, but it seems to me that somebody's body and the material that is contained within their body is no different than somebody's house. the material that's contained within their house. It's their private information, and the state should have to meet certain burdens before they, the state and or private entities in this case, should have to make meet certain burdens or obtain a consent from the individual before taking that information and using it. And the only thing I would add is the reason I think it's important, Representative Kahn brings up some cases. The law, as society, evolves. And in this case, I'd use an example of a credit card. Whoever would have guessed 10, 15, 20 years ago that when your credit card got run through a carbon and they took the carbon and just tossed it into the garbage can, that somebody could come walking by and pick out the carbon, take it and steal all the information on there and use it for identity theft. That's something that evolved over time, and then society had to deal with how you protect that private information. To me, it's no different here. I mean, now that you have genetic mapping, as the technology, the science gets more detailed and can identify things more clearly, it's evolving and we need to evolve, which is why I think these were important to raise.
Can I just ask one question? Do people, should this be taken out of Chapter 13 and put it in 144, or should it be both places?
I think it should be in both.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's go on to the public testimony then, and we'll...
I'm sorry, did Representative Kahn and I agree?
No. That's why Bill took it. No, it doesn't really take, it only takes one part of it out of Chapter 13. Frankly, I think, and I think it's very interesting that you hear from the Department of Health, I think part of the problem that we had with this is, you know, here, Emory, you've got this bill with co-authors of Kahn and Holberg. Do you want to make it Kahn, Holberg, and Emmer? And
yeah,
really
actually,
shock the world.
Actually, Representative Kahn, I think I might want to. I think people in this room should know that your bill, I don't disagree with it. I just don't think it goes far enough when it comes to, you know, making sure that this information remains mine and yours.
Okay. I think the basic problem that we dealt with, and it came up in newborn screening, so that dragged you into this, Mr. Chairman, was that we had, you know, the Department of Health was not able to understand that a Kahn-Holberg agreement had a kind of sanctity about it that they should understand. And the and I think the problem was is that asking for informed consent for newborn screening sample to be used for things other than what they are required to do by federal law, what did require informed consent from the people that were doing it, and it was their job to get that, to present the reason why they wanted to keep it in a way that made people understand and say yes. And if people said no, then that was it. And we, I think, are in complete agreement on that. And we went back and forth over what they were giving to people, and, you know, both of us agreed, you know, maybe at different levels, that it wasn't sufficient, particularly at the point when someone, you know what, they're in their 24 hours of being in a hospital, having just given birth to a baby, and so forth, and what's
I think that, and if I might just expound on that a little bit, and I think that how this all came to light was the Department of Health went, they didn't get legislation passed here that they wanted, so they decided to go to rulemaking to administer their program. And the administrative law judge, in reviewing their application for rules, stated that the Department of Health was never given the authority beyond the newborn screening, the collection and conducting the screening, and their indefinite storage, their use for other research purposes was never authorized by the legislature, and so the administrative law judge denied their request for the rules that they were trying to implement based on the fact that the judge ruled that the Department of Health did not have the authority to do those things. So here we are, it's been about a 3-year tussle, and that's why I want the Department of Health to come up, because you will see that their reaction to these recommendations is basically, we don't want to do any of this.
Okay, and they will come, we'll have them up, but I do want to get to a couple people that have signed up here as well to testify, and we have some time. So is Mr. Church here?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
It's working. Good morning, and thank you, Chairman Thiessen and Mallory, and members of the Civil Justice and Healthcare and Human Services Policy Committees. I'm Professor Tim Church from the Division of Environmental Health Sciences in the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. My research focuses on cancer, especially screening and early detection. I've spoken here at the legislature before about colorectal cancer screening. But I also work with laboratory scientists to study the genetic and environmental causes of cancer in people. I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to you this morning about the proposed legislation. I want to start out by pointing out that we all expect the very best health protection in the world from our doctors and from our public institutions. Knowledge of the best methods to restore and maintain health originally came centuries ago from individual physicians recording their experiences with their individual patients, so there was no problem with privacy. This worked okay for some very common diseases, but most diseases were beyond the reach of these methods. Clinical trials and large epidemiological studies have advanced medical care and public health far beyond what it was back then. We now have the ability to deal with, for example, worldwide epidemics. Researchers like me depend upon volunteers to participate in research that has improved health in the past and will, I hope, continue to do so in the future. The research I do is very expensive, and in addition to improving health, brings jobs and recognition to the state, which I think is a very good thing. A large part of the expense derives from the need to contact individuals periodically to assess their health. Often we collect tissue samples, such as blood, sputum, or tumors, from participants and store them for long-term research needs, not necessarily ones that are even known at the time that they're collected, or not even using methods that are developed at the time of collection. We do so with informed consent and the approval of all relevant institutional review boards. Institutional review boards are federally mandated panels of representatives of the research community and of the community at large who review research to make sure that it respects the principles of autonomy and others outlined in international agreements, as well as assuring that patient safety and privacy is respected. Now, some of the tissue samples that we store are stored in laboratories at the University of Minnesota, and I have direct control of them. And what I'm saying about my own research applies to many, many other researchers at the University of Minnesota and other fine research institutions in the state. However, some of those samples are stored in laboratories across the country or maybe even internationally, and we always consent to do this at the time we collect the tissue. The IRB, even if we didn't want to do it, the IRBs would make sure we did it. The value of these tissues lies, in large part, on the fact that they can be stored for a long period of time, many years, that is, until some of the participants suffer a cancer or other disease. The tissues can then be used to determine what caused the disease or whether the disease can be predicted earlier on and therefore prevented or treated successfully. When the tissue samples are used, it may be by me or one of my fellow researchers at the university, or it could be that the tissue is placed in a large repository that's accessible by researchers that I don't even know, but those researchers need to go through the same sorts of approvals that I go through in order to do my research. Obviously, I would know the identities of those people from whom I collected tissue, but the samples from other parts of the country that I might request from such a repository, I would have no idea who those are. If I were required to reconsent all individuals, it would require disclosing to me those names that I heretofore did not know, and setting about the business of contacting each one. For those participants unfortunate enough to have died from their disease, I would have to find out the names of the relevant proxies and seek them out for permission. The requirements in these bills would make such repositories unworkable. For one thing, the useful life of such repositories can be decades. For example, the prostate, lung, colorectal, and ovarian cancer screening trial, of which Minnesota is the largest center, has enrolled over 150,000 participants and has been going on since 1992. Adding the the burden of yearly reconsenting this many participants would shift research dollars from other pressing research in order to repeatedly ask individuals if they still wanted their tissues to be used. This is an unwarranted burden not only on the research resources, which are spread so thin already, but also burdens participants who would need to spend time and energy reviewing reconsenting materials and dealing with the necessary paperwork. And let me tell you, one of the things that institutional review boards are very concerned about is how much burden research places on participants in that research. Another problem that is that identifiers are often removed from tissue to protect the identity of the participants to maintain their privacy. This means that this method could no longer be used because it would be then impossible to contact on a yearly basis those individuals who contributed the tissues, because we would not know who their names, we would not know their names or the contact information. So this would in fact work against the confidentiality of those individuals who had contributed their tissue to these types of repositories. In summary, let me say that every one of us benefits from the knowledge gained by pooling medical and health information from many people across many populations. Most of us understand this and are happy to have our information used to improve health, as long as it's done respectfully, confidentially, and with respect for our autonomy. Some in our society do not share this attitude, although they still expect the best health possible and enjoy the fruits of knowledge gained from others' generosity. In a pluralistic society, we must respect these concerns, but we must balance them against the needs and wishes of the larger society. Current laws and regulations already provide large amounts of assurance that participants provide meaningful and informed consent. This current legislation, I believe, goes too far in addressing the wishes of the minority to the detriment of the needs of the majority. We want to see health research continue to ensure better and better health with the passing of time. I urge you not to implement those resource-draining barriers contained in this legislation. Thank you.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you. And it's Dr. Church, right?
Yes.
Dr. Church, you were talking about at the Minnesota School of Public Health, that's where you do your research. I'm interested to know, does the University of Minnesota, or is it focused on the Department of Health, does it have a formal committee on bioethics?
Yes, we have a department of bioethics. We also have people trained in ethics who are affiliated with the Institutional Review Board. I serve a dual purpose. I also sit on one of the panels that reviews studies. Of course, I have to recuse myself from reviewing my own research, but yes, their ethics concerns are formally represented in those processes.
In Mr. Chair, Dr. Church, do you at the U of M, do you have a formal written policy when it comes to the issue of genetic specimens, collection, storage, use, a written policy that is in some formal manual produced by the Department of Bioethics?
It's not produced by the Department of Bioethics, which is an academic department, but it's produced by the institutional oversight department, which is responsible for the human subjects review, the institutional review boards, as well as the animal research and compliance with federal regulations.
But there is one.
Yes.
Is there any way, can we go get one, or how would we go about getting a copy of it so we can see what the specific written policy is at the U?
All university policies are online. I don't happen to have the link with me, but they're available online.
Fair. And Mr. Chair, Dr. Church, you were talking about in your research, you rely on volunteers.
Yes, sir.
When you have a volunteer that comes in, are these different studies that you see once in a while advertised in papers or different periodicals looking for volunteers for a study on XYZ?
That's one common way of recruiting. We also use direct mail methods.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Dr. Church, when these people come in, I take it you sit down and you have some type of intake interview where you tell them what the research is about and what they'd be submitting to?
Every subject who is enrolled in our research goes through an informed consent process. which includes discussing with them any concerns they have about the research, and them reading and signing a consent form that has been vetted by the Institutional Review Board, who is very concerned about the fact that participants know what they're getting themselves into, including potential threats to their privacy and confidentiality.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Church, then once you have gone through that process, you talked about you have to go through, actually you talked about other researchers when you were talking about the repository, that other researchers would have to go through the same set of approvals that you have to go through, but I don't think you told us specifically what approvals do you have to go through to get access to the repository. And for instance, you referred to, is it the prostate?
Yes, the PLC, or the prostate lung colon.
Thank you. The acronym is much more pleasant.
This is a centralized a repository that I think physically resides in Frederick, Maryland, and is administered by the National Cancer Institute. The National Cancer Institute has an institutional review board that oversees all of the research associated not only with the PLCO, but with the other, what they call extramural research, research that goes on outside the actual National Cancer Institute, like this study. And in addition, there is a very rigorous review process for each study that requests use of those samples. And part of that review process is to ensure that mechanisms are in place to protect the confidentiality and privacy of all of the subjects who might be contributing to that. And there are no names or addresses attached to any of these samples.
Right. Mr. Chair, last one, because that helps me a lot. It seems that your concern here was focused around something you kept referring to as reconsenting.
Right.
You know, that's going to put an unnecessary burden. But who's talking about reconsenting? Because it sounds as though you you go through this very detailed intake interview process, and by your own testimony, you make sure that you get a fully and completely informed consent from anybody who's participating, and then they have to sign off that they have given consent, and they understand they're not only allowing you access to their private information for purposes of your research, but that that might be available to others for research, and they're advised of that, and they sign off on that. That's what I understand.
If I understand the legislation correctly, they would be required to reconsent for every new use of the material, as well as the consent expires in a year. Over a 20-year period or a 30-year period, that would be 30 times that they would have to be contacted and reconsented, because this material is used every year.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Church, my apologies. That might be where I'm right and Representative Kahn is wrong, but we'll just leave it at that.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Actually, Representative Bunn.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask the testify a little bit more about the issue of de-identifiers and de-identifying data. I've been involved in a lot of research early in my career involved with de-identifying data, proprietary data corporations for use in public national data sets. And you mentioned two things. In your first part of your testimony, you mentioned that frequently it's de-identified. But then just now you talked about, I think in regards to the repository, that there was no names or addresses. Could you talk a little further about the extent of de-identification, at what point that takes place, and also comment on what examples where you wouldn't do that, de-identify, under what circumstances and how few those might be?
Dr. Church.
This, Ms. Chairman, member, this is sort of a messy area in a couple of ways. One is that HIPAA defines identifiers in a very peculiar way.
Mm-hmm.
It includes not only the things we would ordinarily think of as identifiers, but things like the date of service,
mm-hmm.
Which could be the date of diagnosis, which is a key piece of information for research, but doesn't in any usual way allow one to identify anybody if you don't have some other information about them already.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say de-identify, I mean strictly that. To remove all of those pieces of identifying information. Now, the repository in Frederick, Maryland has dates of service on it. It just doesn't have names and addresses, mm-hmm. the things that would be required in order to contact somebody mm-hmm. to reconsent them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the reason I call it de-identified is that we distinguish between de-identification and anonymization. De-identification means that identifiers aren't there, but one could go back and get them because some blinded list is maintained that allows you to reconnect to that data and get that information.
Mm-hmm.
Anonymization, which happens less frequently, but when you're talking about tissue and widely used biorepositories, anonymization is used, and this breaks the link so that you can't go back and find out who that person is. And so anonymized tissue data banks would be strictly impossible under this legislation. De-identified ones would be possible, but if you think about samples that come from all over the country or even all over the world and having to track back and figure out which ones you actually need to go after further consent and which ones don't would be a burdensome thing both for the, like I say, for the researchers as well as the people who maybe hadn't thought about that research for years and years and years. They'd have to be re-educated to what the research is, and so there's burden on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Representative Buck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Doctor. I'm really, let's separate from the linking back, from the needing to contact them portion of this again. That's really not what I'm trying to get at in here. I'm trying to get at the extent to which in the current system, personal information, name, address is removed, therefore privacy is maintained. So I want to ask it in three ways. One is, well, under what circumstances for research purposes or medical purposes would you need to keep it identified with name or contact information, or you would have it de-identified versus you would have it anonymous? I mean, those three levels, it sounds like they all exist in what you're dealing with. And under what circumstances would it be important to have one versus the other two? And
well,
why?
We want to continue following somebody, we have to have enough information to be able to recontact them. So an ongoing research enterprise where we're periodically contacting people, we need to maintain contact information. In addition, we need to maintain the information that links new information to old information when we're interested in following people over time, regardless of whether we have to contact them or not.
Mm-hmm.
We need some sort of identifier to link mm-hmm. forward. It doesn't have to be name and address, mm-hmm. things that most people would consider violations of privacy if it got out. It could be simply a study number, but mm-hmm. HIPAA considers those also identifiers.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to say those are still identified. Now, when we actually go to store the data, especially if we store it off-site or with a central coordinating center for studies that require many different geographic locations to participate, but a central collection of the data, those central databases do not have any of the contact information. We at the University of Minnesota in particular have been in the forefront of ensuring that that sort of information is not spread around past the original researcher who has a need to know that contact information. However, we do keep that contact information in case there is some additional information that either needs to be passed back to the individual regarding, say for example, if we were collecting radiographs of their lungs and some study found a previously undiscovered tumor, we'd have to be able to get in contact with them and let them know about that. And then anonymization usually happens after a study is completed, the original study is completed, and the participants have consented to their information and materials to be included in a biorepository. Then the links are destroyed, the data is packaged as anonymous data, and then those are made available to legitimate researchers who go through the approval procedures and the appropriate IRB mm-hmm. approvals.
Okay. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two really brief questions, Dr. Church. Does your research protocol allow for an individual to opt out at any point?
Yes, it does.
And so if I might, they have control going in with consent and have control by the option for opt-out.
Yes.
All right. And my second question, is there anything under current science more individually identifiable than DNA material?
No.
And so if you are saying that you are dealing with de-identified samples, the reality is that under current standards, the material that you are working with is the most individually identifiable material known to man at this point.
In a sense, but if you think about it, if I had a copy of your DNA right here, then I have no way of knowing it was yours. So it requires additional information in order to use that DNA to know it's you. In other words, I would have to already have your DNA to know that this DNA was yours.
Right.
And that's not accomplishable under sort of routine circumstances. Not very many people have the capability of sequencing DNA.
Right, but Mr. Chair, the fact is that even if one entity has DNA material in which they don't have the names, addresses, etc., the ability to link that information to other bases that do, all you need is the genetic material with that link.
Yeah, you need the genetic in both places.
Right.
So it's not a very good, even though it's a perfect one, it's not a very good link because it's not easy to derive without already knowing the information that you seek to know.
Right, but I think one example where we're seeing this is some states are now taking DNA samples for every person that's arrested, whether or not there's a conviction or whatever, and they're holding them and databasing them and then running, and then as Representative Kahn talked about, you can, with pretty good predictability, determine whether an individual sample is of a blood relative to another individual. And so where all this goes, we don't know where we're going to be 10, 20 years from now relative to this. So I think that is why some people are so concerned that we have good standards in place and that individuals have some rights around that information moving forward.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that how California found this multi-year serial rapist just in the news yesterday, right?
Mr. Chair, that doesn't surprise me, but one of the things, there were some articles in the New York Times recently, and what they're finding is that these databases now that they're collecting are so disproportionately weighted towards minority communities and the ramifications of that and ethical standards, et cetera. And Britain has been doing this for a number of years, and they have some interesting consequences that are showing up now as well.
I think we have to move on. Thank you very much for coming down. I think we're going to move around here. Ms. Brace, do you want to come up? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mulvey is not here. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm President of Citizens Council on Healthcare, and I was also a member of the Minnesota Genetic Information Task or Work Group, and provided the work group with a minority report because of our concerns that came out of that work group. Particularly having to do with ownership and the three-generation pedigrees and some of those details. Well, thank you very much for holding this important hearing on legislation regarding genetic privacy and DNA property rights. I'm just going to address four items: individual rights, the danger of violating those rights, what the public says, and the specific bills in front of you. First, individual rights. Individuals have civil and privacy rights under the Fourth Amendment. Individuals have patient rights in the healthcare system and human service rights in research. And when it comes to children, there are also parent rights. Finally, individuals have DNA property rights. Our bodies, our DNA, our genetic codes are not public property. They are not state property. They are not the property of doctors, hospitals, and researchers, but they are private property. There is nothing more personal, more ours, than our own DNA. Locked inside our genes are secrets and possibilities that we may or may not want to know. secrets and possibilities that we have a right not to know. And individuals also have a right not to be known by others, and this is called privacy. Unless you have already had your DNA sequenced, you do not know what it might say. And no matter what it says, it may or may not be correct. It may or may not happen. But the consequences of knowing or being known down to your genes can be detrimental, depending on who knows and what they do about it. History is important when considering the future. I brought these two books by the New York Times bestselling author Edwin Black, and I suggest everyone read them. This one is called War Against the Weak, and it goes through a history of how eugenics went from England to America and our sterilization programs, and then how it was picked up by Hitler and used in Germany. And then Mr. Black wrote another book, which is called IBM and the Holocaust. And IBM and the Holocaust talks about how the IBM company created what was called the Holocaust machine, which you can find at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And what that did was it essentially, everywhere that the Nazis went, they had everyone do a census. And all that information was then put on punch cards that were created by IBM and the Holocaust. And then when they would come into a city, they would use the sorting machine, which you can also find at the Holocaust Museum, and they would sort out the details, the unfit, the asocial, etc., that came out of those punch cards. And people wondered why they were so efficient in finding the people that they wanted to exterminate, and that was why, because they used the census to do that. Now, here was what, as the IBM plant in Berlin opened, here is what Willy Haidinger, one Nazi official, said. He said, "The physician examines the human body and determines whether all organs are working to the benefit of the entire organism. We are very much like the physician in that we dissect cell by cell the German cultural body. We report every individual characteristic on a little card." Now, the Nazis did not have the genome sequencing capabilities that we're about to get today, but imagine if they did. We should not forget the lessons of the past, or we will be doomed to repeat them with even greater technological wizardry today and efficiency. The public does not support the storage and use of blood for research without specific informed written consent. Last November at the annual newborn screening conference, a study was presented. That study found that 56% of parents are very unwilling to have their baby's blood used for research without permission. Only 11% were very willing. That study also found that of those patients not willing to permit research, 67% were not willing to have the baby's blood stored. The adult public feels the same way about their own blood. In what is considered the first population-based survey on the issue, a 2001 study that you can find on the CDC website found that only 42% of 2,621 respondents were in favor of both blood donation and long-term storage for genetic research. 21% were not willing to donate or store blood for genetic research under any circumstances. 27% said they would not be willing to donate blood for genetic research even with the insurance of confidentiality and anonymity. And given what has been said already here today, it occurs to me that I should tell you that the NIH reported in a presentation that, as Representative Holberg said, that DNA is the ultimate identifier, and that what is, even though it cannot be identified today as easily as Dr. Church was saying, it will be able to be identified in the future. And you can also, and I could provide that too, that's from the NIH. A Gallup survey on medical privacy found that 93% of the public want medical and government researchers to obtain permission before studying a person's genetic information. 86% said that the doctor should ask permission before testing for genetic factors in the course of taking blood for other things, like blood sugar, high cholesterol, etc. Clearly, the public is on the side of consent. When members of the public come to the hospital, they want to be treated as a patient, with all the individual rights and all ethical standards intact. They do not want to walk into a hospital as a patient and come out as a research subject. That would be a violation of the public's trust. The Emmer bills before you would protect the rights and the lives of these individuals. The Kahn bill, and I can, after hearing what she had to say. It's just clear that she's thinking on the right side. Thank you, Rosanna Tan. But we are very concerned about the fact that it repeals 13.386 and the fact that when it repeals that, it takes this collection of the most intimate details information that we have in individuals out of the Government Data Practices Act, meaning that it's not protected by those strong legal protections in the Act and the ability of people to sue when, for instance, the government decides to violate the law, as the Minnesota Health Department has now, and as nine families have sued. So what we would ask is that you not reward this kind of behavior, that you keep the protections within the Government Data Practices Act for government entities, and that you act now to guarantee civil privacy, patient, parent, and property rights and protections of citizens and patients, both newborns and adults. And the last thing that I would say, just as a comment to what has already been said, is that, because I forgot to tell you this, but there were other written comments that have come in, and I didn't know if you've received them, but I'll have this in for the record. But the other thing was the case that Representative Tom was talking about was John Moore. And John Moore discovered that the clinic was having him come down for 7 years, I believe it was 2 or 4 times a year, simply to harvest his blood for the fact of doing this patent, which was then sold for $15 million to a company, Sandoz, which has made $3 billion already at the time that I write about this, which was several years ago. So that was, he actually considered himself to be harvested, and that's what he said in his comments. And then lastly, I can't remember who said this. It might have been Dr. Church or it might have been somebody on here, but you know, the whole idea of the majority versus the minority, our country was founded on the principles of protecting the minority, not serving the majority. So I just want to leave that as a final comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Weaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Grace, I just really want to make the comment here that I think that what we hear in this hearing is that this is not about people who care about privacy and people who don't. And I must say, I really think it's very unfortunate that it gets characterized that way. I don't think there's a person around this table who isn't very, very concerned about privacy. I think the issue really is, how do we balance the very important concerns of privacy versus the needs of society? Very good example of this is what we talked about with the way the databases are used sometimes by law enforcement. Now, personally, it makes me very nervous, the idea of using having your relative DNA and then timing you from that. I am made very uncomfortable by that. On the other hand, the idea that we can find a serial rapist or murderer through the use of that data, I don't think anyone in this room would say, give back the data now. We don't want to know that that person is out there murdering people. So I think we have to be very careful about how we talk about this, because there are legitimate interests on both sides. And I think what Dr. Church really brought to us, you know, I think you're right. Nobody enters the hospital wanting to be a research subject. And of course, you know, we're all horrified that that might occur. On the other hand, when you enter the hospital and you have a cancer, you want the benefit that comes from the research that's been done on other people's samples, because you want your tumor treated. And you know, if your child has one of these genetic diseases, and catching that and giving appropriate treatment can save them from a life of severe disability, you want that benefit. So I just want to make that comment that the way this gets characterized, and I don't know why that is, I think it's easy to get people mad at something, and to use the word ownership rights and characterize it that way is really effective in getting people really upset and mad, and it's really easy to you know, raise money and get people upset if you're saying, oh, here, somebody's for privacy and somebody's against privacy. But I really want people to understand that that is not what's going on here. I think we're all struggling with technologies that are very new. We don't know what the world is going to look like. Nobody, you know, nobody here wants a scenario like, you know, not the use of information and so on. And, you know, so what are we going to do? We're going to say, well, let's stop all genetic research. Let's, you know, have none of this. Well, then you go to the hospital and your cancer perhaps could have been cured, but now there isn't a treatment available for that. So let's just be very careful about how we talk about this and not characterize people as being against privacy rights.
Ms. Briggs.
Mr. Chair. Well, several things, Representative Liebling. One would be just to say that Dr. Church, it's very clear from Dr. Church's testimony that they spend a great deal of time getting the individual's consent. And that's very good, and we're very, very supportive of that. And even better to consent to the fact that these could be used for anything. But it is interesting to note that Dr. Hank Greeley from Stanford says the one thing that's to note about anonymization is that it keeps people from actually being able to get out of studies that they find objectionable. So there are things to realize that not all research is good, but research that you want to participate in, and anyone with cancer, probably if you ask them, is going to want to participate. Clearly, Dr. Church has gotten a lot of people to participate voluntarily in the research. But I get concerned when I hear comments like doing it for society. And I think, well, who is society? You know, who is the grand society? Is that a group of people sitting around the table, or is that all of us as individuals? I mean, who is that society, and how do you decide who gets to make that kind of a decision? And the last thing that I would say is, as individuals, we all have Fourth Amendment rights, which is the right for us to be protected from the government entering our homes, entering our genetic cells, and finding out information about us that is not theirs.
If the audience would please, that's really not appropriate for this kind of a setting, so if we could just not do, no.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, I did want to say one other thing, that we have a new study out to show how many peer-reviewed journals are now talking about the fact that newborn screening, the potentially for eugenics in newborn screening, and that is available on our website.
Mr. Chair, yeah, and all I would add, Representative Liebling, is that we do all have the same interest, and I know how passionate you are about it and privacy, but I think it's a matter of whose perspective you're looking at it from. And when you make, and not you personally, but when people make statements that those of us, and I'll just state the perspective, there are those of us who look at it from the perspective of the individual, and there are those of us who look at it from the perspective of, and I'll use Dr. Church's term, the pluralistic society that we live in. You either look at it from it's mine, and for society's good, I will consent. And I think it's also a matter of trust, you know, and I'll use newborn screening as an example. I think there is a distrust by the state when you look at it from the state's perspective that the individuals will not make the right decision, which I don't believe in. I think the individuals, parents, if they're given the right information and told, we're going to run these tests on your newborn child, this is what it's for, you're going to get people that say, absolutely, that's important to me. Now, it's the perspective as to how we look at privacy, and I think that it's very important that people understand that the way this country was, I mean, our freedoms are based on the individual, not on the collective rights against the individual. It's protection of God's given rights of the individual from the others. And then we have to work together from there. When people say things like, you want to protect your personal privacy, you believe your genetic information belongs to you, that you want to kill programs like newborn screening, or your statement just a second ago that you want to stop all genetic research, I think that's, you know, if you're giving the criticism, you should accept it back, that that's all every bit, in fact, more damaging when we're trying to have this conversation. Nobody wants to kill genetic testing. Nobody wants to kill the newborn screening program. I think what we all want is to ensure that the rights of the individual are protected while at the same time we try to achieve what you're talking about for the good of the society.
Well, thank you, Representative Emmer. I mean, I think we do agree on a lot of this, and I was not saying that anyone wants to kill all genetic research. I was just saying that's one extreme of this that we could take it to. And certainly I don't think anybody here is saying that, but just remember, this isn't only about when you go into the hospital and you, whether or not you want to be a research subject or allow your DNA to be used. It's also about coming to the hospital and having available to you the results of the kind of research that Dr. Church is talking about. So, you know, let's all remember, you know, that absolutely we need to be concerned about the individual. I mean, my background is as a criminal defense attorney. The Fourth Amendment means an awful lot to me. I mean, I have spent a good deal of my career defending those rights, as a matter of fact, and I personally actually think that we've invaded them a bit too much in a lot of spheres. But there's always a balance of what are we gaining, as for example, stopping a serial murderer versus what do we give up as individuals. And the problem here is that none of us knows when we are going to be the patient in the hospital needing the help that other people have graciously given us at that point. So, you know, that's why it's very easy to say, you know, don't invade my privacy here, because I don't see at the same moment I'm worried about that the potential benefit to me as an individual. I'm just saying, let's not demonize people who also want to make sure the information is available to those who need it at the point that they're a patient, where the research also benefits them.
President Khan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I hate to agree with Representative Emmer twice in a day, but
the world is starting to balance out, Mr. Chairman.
But one of the things that we've, and I believe Representative Holberg and I, and I really believe that that people will consent to a lot of the things that people say we're trying to stop if you give them the appropriate information. And where Representative Holberg was disagreeing with the Department of Health was that we didn't think they were going far enough in terms of giving people the information as to how it would benefit them personally to have this information stored forever almost. But and we think that that's the case that can be made. I'll go back to the report, which I said that one of the non-law change recommendations were the call for more educational resources in terms of the number of people who have to be educated along with this. I always give great credit to O.J. Simpson, because he was, rather than Watson and Crick, who were my former heroes in this issue, it was O.J. Simpson who made DNA a household word and made people understand what that issue was. But the I guess I need to talk to Dr. Church at greater length to find out, but we obviously need some language to tweak the concept of repositories and the concept of anonymously collected data. We also need something to collect. We have new informed consent requirements coming up. We need to do things about grandfathering and stuff that was collected, so, you know, to meet the description of the things that we really don't want him and his researchers to have to do. So that's and I almost saw Emmer nodding a few times, so that's something that I want to work on, and maybe all of us will work on to see if we can get a version of this bill that not only Khan, Holberg, and Emmer will sign on to, but maybe Liebling too.
Okay, Laura, Representative Broad, and then we're going to have to move on.
Representative Holberg and Representative Emmer have gotten into the details of this legislation significantly, and I just want to kind of bring it back to a more simplistic viewpoint. I think the case can be made, Representative Khan, I agree with you on that. The case can be made to individuals and to families for why they might want to go this direction. But that's what baffles me. That's what baffles me, is that if that case can be made, and we believe it can, why are we scared of consent? That's what baffles me. And that's what it appears in the legislation, in little pieces of it, very detailed components of the legislation, is that we're scared of consent. We're scared of allowing families and parents to opt in to something. So let's make the case to them. Let's recognize their individual rights. And then we can move forward in a way that I think creates better trust in the system, creates better trust in the research, and creates less cynicism over what could be happening to something that belongs to an individual. And so I think that there's room to find some common ground, but it just baffles me that we don't trust consent.
You point out a point in the legislation that says that we don't...
I think she's talking about other legislation.
A combination of...
So,
yeah. Okay.
Frank, IOC. And I believe you just have a letter that you're going to be presenting, reading to the committee? Or that we can hand out, yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Frank Yossi. I'm a male director of state government relations, and I have copies of the letter. I need to apologize. Kathy Miley, who is in the male legal department, was a member of the genetic information work group, and I'm reading my testimony, her statement. She's out of the state today, and I'm unable to be here. And I also want to apologize to Representative Emmer and Kohlberg and Bunn, and possibly Lee Ding, because I'm not going to be able to answer the detailed operational questions. Males, please be able to comment on the report and three bills that have been introduced that address the collection, storage, and use of genetic information. Males supports the principles of privacy, of protection of privacy and confidentiality set out in the genetic information report, but it urges the state not to take action that will have the effect of creating Minnesota as an island where health care delivery becomes more administratively burdened, medical research becomes impractical, and our population suffers as a consequence. The work group report has both specific and general recommendations. While Mayo generally has no objection to the recommendations in the report does not go into sufficient detail to address many important considerations that surround the regulation of the creation and use of genetic information. These three bills, in trying to provide more of this detail, create significant problems for healthcare in general and healthcare research in particular. The sections of bills dealing with collection, storage, and use of genetic information are much more restrictive in federal law and regulation and laws in other states in the area of protecting genetic information. In addition, more protections were added last year with the congressional passage of GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. Passage of the proposed sections in these bills relating to collection, storage, and use would make Minnesota an outlier and significantly impact the work of Minnesota's healthcare providers as well as its researchers. We urge considerations of laws that protect against use that would harm an individual rather than regulating the front-end collection and storage of information or material that contains or refers to genetic information. Storage should be permitted, but the use limited to those purposes authorized by law or with the patient consent. The proposals in these bills all burden the healthcare system at the point of collection, and we think this is the wrong approach and puts an unnecessary burden on the healthcare system. Proposed amendments to the state cancer surveillance system, 3-degree pedigrees, and the use of VCA specimens are acceptable to Mayo Clinic. These very discrete issues were discussed thoroughly by the work group, and the recommendations are sufficiently narrow and focused on the use of this type of genetic information to provide a balance between the risk of harm and privacy interests of the individual and the needs of the program. I'd like to give you some examples of how the bills would impact day-to-day clinic and hospital practice. Some provisions in the bills add an unnecessary paperwork burden on health care providers by requiring a consent form to create and maintain a medical record. How does it do this? The definitions of genetic information include a family history about a particular disease or disorder that is known to have a genetic component if that information might be used in providing medical care to that individual. It is standard medical practice to ask a patient for a family medical history. Questions that are asked include those about a family history of disease, some of which have genetic origins. If a patient has a parent or other relative with a genetic form of cancer, such as colon or breast cancer, and provides this information to a doctor, it appears to us the bills would require the written informed consent of the relative in addition to the patient. We think this is not reasonable or necessary. These bills would prohibit the creation of a medical record unless prior to the creation of that record, a very specific written consent form was signed. We know of nowhere in this country that written informed consent is required to create a medical record. Under one of the bills, in fact, this consent would need to be renewed annually. We find this requirement to be an unnecessary measure. The bills would require a written consent for virtually a consent form for virtually any laboratory test. Mayo Clinic performs more than 7,000 laboratory tests each working day. Under these bills, the drawing of blood, collection of urine, or removal of any tissue for a diagnostic test would be considered the collection of genetic information, since some of the proposed bills define the biological material as genetic information in and of itself. For the tests that are specifically looking for a genetic component, the discussion of the need for the test and consent to perform the test are a routine part of clinical practice. Obtaining a consent form to draw blood to perform a cholesterol or blood sugar test is simply unnecessary. Some language would prevent routine quality improvement and equipment calibration and testing. Certification and accrediting agencies require quality improvement and calibration activities. By prohibiting the storage of biological materials without a written consent form specifying the use of the material, required and routine quality practices would be impaired or made much more difficult. The retention and use of a specimen without any identifier on it or information recorded in any way that could be linked to the individual presents no risk of harm to that individual. I'd also like to explain how these bills will significantly impact the research and business operations of Mayo Clinic other than direct patient care. The bills put an important Mayo Clinic business at a competitive disadvantage with its national competitors, none of whom are in Minnesota, nor would they be affected by the law. Mayo Medical Laboratories receive specimens in Rochester each day from all over the United States and the world. MML is a growing reference laboratory business that has created new jobs and provides tax revenue to the state of Minnesota. As an aside of my own comment here, in the last decade, Mayo has added 800 new jobs in Rochester and in Minnesota. 80% of those jobs have been added in this laboratory. That's not going to happen if this bill passes. Each day, thousands of diagnostic tests, 90% of which originate outside Minnesota, come to Rochester to be processed, and the reports sent back to the doctors ordering these tests. How many of those doctors are going to continue to collect and send specimens to Minnesota if MML has to require that a specific consent form be signed and sent along with these specimens? I would suggest to you that this business will no longer be in Minnesota. The bills, in fact, fail to address one of the larger risks for release of genetic information, and that is by business, not healthcare providers, selling whole genome screening over the internet for anyone who will spend the money to have the screening done. Nothing in this bill would restrict how these businesses, which are not healthcare providers, collect, report, or use the information they obtain on specifically identifiable individuals. Mayo Clinic's ability to compete with other academic health centers around the United States for grants from the Federal National Institutes of Health and other private funding sources would be impaired. These bills would impose a unique set of burdens on Mayo and other researchers in Minnesota and that other competing researchers do not face. In some cases, it means research involving large collections of specimens may not even be able to be carried out in Minnesota. Many research projects require large collections reflecting entire communities that would be unavailable if selective consent was required. Much important research is performed on existing records and material that has been collected for some other purpose. The federal research regulations recognize that when information is collected in this way and the data is recorded such that there is no way to relate the information back to the source, no harm is presented to the individual and no additional consent is required. Questions that involve looking for patterns and diseases that affect a very small percentage of the population but can have significant impact on an affected individual would not be able to be answered if large portions of the population could not be contacted or declined to respond to a request for consent to use their information. I can give you one very specific example that is eerily reflective of what is on the front pages of our newspapers and televisions and everywhere else this week. The need to determine the cause of side effects from a flu vaccine. In the 1970s, when the last influenza epidemic took place and there were mass immunizations around the country, many people became ill with a disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome. It was the epidemiologist at the Mayo Clinic looking at the medical records of the residents of Olmsted County, which we call the Rochester Epidemiology Project, who were able to determine the relationship between the flu vaccine and the disease. Without the ability to look at the medical records and biological specimens of a large population, it would not have been possible for this connection to be made. Genetic research has significant implications for protecting public health. I could provide more examples, but these illustrate my point that these bills would have immediate and significant effect on Minnesota's largest private employer. Mayo Clinic suggests that existing law concerning release of medical records is adequate to protect the interests of individuals. The privacy interest that an individual has in his or her medical record is the same interest that is to be honored in the collection, testing, and use of biological specimens from which genetic information might be obtained. These bills would simply create incredible burdens without providing significant increased protection beyond what is already in federal and state law. Thank you for the opportunity to present this statement.
Thank you. And I think Mr. Asti doesn't have any more data to answer questions particularly.
Well,
he's presenting on behalf of someone.
I understand, Mr. Chair, but I'd like him to take them.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any questions for Mr. Asti.
Okay. You want to make a comment?
Yeah, I'd like you to take something back. I'm incredibly disappointed. I don't mean to shoot the messenger at all, Mr. Asti, but you know what? To come in and talk about, well, and I'll just go to your last comment that I was writing a note. If the privacy interest that an individual has in his or her medical record is the same interest that is to be honored in the collection, testing, and use of biological specimens from which genetic information might be obtained, if it's the same, then these bills shouldn't make a bit of difference. And I understand that they might change some ways you go at it, but Mayo, with its reputation, its absolute cutting-edge ability in our healthcare market, to come in and say, to take the attitude that genetic information, this would be way too difficult to require consent, and boy, you know, you're gonna cause the sky to fall. It's extremely disappointing to me. I mean, it shows me that we've allowed the last 20, 30 years to go to a point where apparently the healthcare providers, and I know that all the doctors I know, and Dr. Church was here earlier talking when we were talking about bioethics, they take that extremely serious. I know that. But they shouldn't be the ones to get to determine how we're going to decide what happens with our information. They shouldn't be the ones to tell us that, we honor your privacy. No, we should be telling you folks, and I just, to come in and deliver a message that this is going to kill jobs in the state of Minnesota, you know, that to link that somehow to my private information, genetic information, I think is it crosses the line, and I hope that Mayo, who I think is one of the greatest institutions on the face of the planet, and I hope we never lose. And I hope it continues to flourish and provide the kind of service and resource that Minnesotans have, in some cases, taken for granted, I understand. I don't want to see that get affected, but I'd like to see this get turned around so that when we work together, it starts with the individual as opposed with the providers. And I just hope I delivered that right. I don't mean to go after the messenger. I know you were delivering it, but I think it's important.
And listen, remember, I think part of it, coming back to what Representative Liebling was talking about, is it's more the specificity and prescriptive language of some of the, you know, I think that there is work that we can do about exactly what these consent forms would require. It sounds like there is a lot of consent, and I don't think Mayo is saying we shouldn't necessarily have that consent. Is how do you design that form? And so there's pieces in, I think, for instance, some of your legislation that requires you got to list three different options, and I think there's work that we can do together around that stuff, and I think that's what Mr. Iosi was getting at.
Mr. Chair, I heard that from both you, Representative Labeling, Representative Kahn. I did not hear that from the testimony. I heard that how we can't do this, and it will create unnecessary and unfair burdens in the marketplace, and I'm sorry, but that just didn't sit with me well. If I heard it wrong, my apologies to the testifier.
Okay, and I think we do want to... Let's have the Department of Health come up for a bit here. Thank you for coming today. And I know there's no particular testimony you have, but Representative Holberg, unless you wanted to make a statement first. Well, you should identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Kristen Longcourt from the Health Department.
And Mr. Chair, first I'd like to say thank you for being here. I know your department's really busy with the flu and everything.
Maybe I could just give a brief update. We are extremely busy, Representative Holberg, and the two members that actually served on the genetic work group, Dr. Ruth Winfield, our state epidemiologist, who I'm sure you've all seen in the news. He's obviously not able to be here today. And Dr. Louise Leal, also from the public health lab. The lab staff, our infectious disease staff, are working nonstop. And I hope that I've communicated enough with you all about the N1H1 novel influenza so that you all have the information that you need. We do have our second probable case in the state this morning. We just released another news release in Isanti County. So I've been in contact with Representative Eastland and Representative Faust and then the Senate members also. If you or your constituents have any concerns, any questions, please direct them to our hotline that I sent the telephone number in the email or to our website. There is just a wealth of information on the health department's website and encourage them to call their doctors as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, in your packet you have the genetic information report, and if you go nearly to the back, there's a letter from the Department of Health. And if you go to page 4 of the Department of Health letter, you'll see near the top of the page is the current law and proposed language on from the Department of Health. And if you see in the middle of the page what the Department of Health is providing, and when this study was presented to the Civil Law Committee, the Health Department didn't present specifically, but did come to the table. And basically, if you read the language they're proposing, they're asking for the Minnesota Department of Health to be exempt from the statute, and they have the including but not limited to language in there for how they can use genetic information. And so from my perspective, it's very frustrating. It's a continuation of what we've seen in the newborn screening program, and I'm just wondering, at the time of the civil law hearing, I asked the department to number one, tell the legislature if this was in fact the governor's position, if he approved this letter, and I never got any feedback on that request. And so I'm just wondering where this proposed language came from. Is it the administration's position that the Department of Health should be exempt from all of these standards related to genetic information, or can you give us a little more information since you were in the Civil Justice Committee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, as I said, at that time, the Health Department was members of this work group. Dr. Leal was a member. Dr. Winfield was a member. We had other staff that would participate in the various work groups as we could. The work group asked for comments on the draft report. So these were our comments, the Health Department's comments on the draft report. They were written by Health Department staff that had participated on the committee and then submitted to the Department of Administration. They were not reviewed or sent to the governor's office for review or approval. But what you're looking at is their technical comments on a draft report. This is not legislation that we had intended to propose. This is not, you have not seen this by that the department had introduced this year at all. These were just technical comments. And you'll see that through, I believe, also on page 5 and 6, there were some other, areas where we just provided some technical comments. And we do that for a number of issues. We try to help members when they have legislation that's been introduced. We try to help all members of the legislature so that we're able to technically implement a piece of legislation. So we would always give that kind of technical assistance. So that was our intent with this.
Yeah, and thank you. And as the members will see, that it's actually this section was prefaced by the Minnesota Department of Health suggests that the generic privacy statute be amended in Subdivision 3 as follows. So it was a recommendation, you know, of language. And it's very concerning, and I'm really sorry. Thank you very much for your comments. I don't have any other questions. I just wanted to point out this continuing attitude of the Minnesota Department of Health, and don't make this apply to us. And I'm really sorry that Representative Liebling left, because, members, I think what you need to know is that there's balance on both ends of this issue, and we now, for the first time, have seen nearly 100 families opt out of newborn screening even being done. And I believe, in large part, it's because of a distrust of what's happening in this program and with these samples. I'm hearing increasingly from parents that are paying the $200, they're bringing their own blood collection kit to the hospital with them. They have the blood taken and sent to a private lab so that the Department of Health does not ever receive any of the information. They have a right to do that. But if we do not address this issue in a balanced way and give people the opportunity to make choices about this program, you are going to have diminished samples. It's going to suppress participation in this program, as we're already seeing. And those that have means are going to choose to have this done privately. And so then all of the discussions about having a good sample set, et cetera, the Department of Health and Mayo, et cetera, are going to see increasing numbers of individuals make sure that the blood samples, in the case of the newborn screening, never get to the state and into this program. So it works both ways. We have to recognize that for people whose privacy is utmost to them and are concerned about this issue, if we don't allow them the opportunity to control their destiny around these issues, the effect for those individuals, it will suppress their access to health care by their own choice. In other words, they will not want to have tests done, because if they don't know that they can make sure that it's never used for research, they may choose not to have things done as a result of not wanting to do that. So we are already seeing that with the newborn screening. I think that we have to assure that people have rights relative to this information and can make choices. I firmly believe that if people are given all the information about the importance and they feel that they have control, they will allow that to go forward and will participate in research for the public good. But the history around the Department of Health and some of these issues has not been so good, and we need to set up legislation that puts together standards that the citizens can be assured that their rights will be respected as well.
And I would say that, and I hope people would generally acknowledge that the legislation that I'm carrying that's moving through the legislature this year, we'll see what happens with it, actually does move very aggressively in that direction. Not good enough for everybody, I understand, but it would be very clear about what the uses possibly could be and give very clear options that wouldn't happen in kind of very discreet chunks, so people have lots of choices and lots of control over that information. And I think that it's important that that information gets out there as well, because I don't think the fact that that's the direction that we're trying to go has been communicated to the general public as well, and that concerns me as well. And we need to have an open discussion, and that is why I said I'd prefer not to have the cheering or not, because this means a lot to a lot of people, and we have to have an open discussion if we're going to solve it.
And Mr. Chair, in closing, I won't say anything more, I know time's run out, but I am grateful that you had the hearing. I hope that there are legislators in the room today that have learned a few new things, are willing to engage in this discussion and this process. This is an issue that is not going to go away. It's going to continue to evolve year after year, and I'm sure Representative Kahn and I would love to have bills with more people's name on it than just she and I.
Yeah, Representative.
Mr. Chair, what I wanted to ask, and maybe you can answer it or somebody else in the committee, the witness was, since that administrative law judge determined that the department didn't have the authority for several things, including the storage, my understanding was the department, and this follows up on Representative Holberg talking about the trust issue, the department was supposed to have destroyed those samples, but it's been almost 2 years now, and as far as I know, that hasn't been done. Is that still the case?
My understanding is the samples have not been destroyed. I think there's a disagreement about what the, you know, they withdrew the rulemaking that the administrative law judge had issued. So, I mean, it wasn't a district court. So, I mean, I think there's issues around that. So,
I understand, but for the record, this is part of the trust problem, is that what people in the public see that start to observe this, they see a department that went to try and skirt around the rules, got a ruling they didn't want. They were told they didn't have the authority, which would tell them, most people would think, you don't have the authority to store it, so you got to destroy it. So what are they doing? They're holding on to it until they can get the law changed so that they can keep it. And that doesn't help the trust issue.
And we're not trying to keep it anymore, as you know.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Conn, and then if Ms. Zierhut could come up to the table.
If I could just say one quick word, maybe what we need to get out and for these people who are all going to private labs is that there are no restrictions at all on what the private labs do in terms of selling, reuse, and so forth.
Mr. Chair?
President Holberg.
Actually, in the contract between the individual and the company, those things can be specified, and in fact, the people that are using the private labs now to do the newborn screening are very cognizant of that and have checked into that thoroughly.
I would imagine. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I am extremely nervous as this is my first time at a hearing. My name is Heather Zierhut. I'm a genetic counselor at the University of Minnesota Medical Center at Fairview. I have a master's degree in genetic counseling from the University of Minnesota. With this degree, I have expertise in genetic conditions and in the clinic working with patients. My master's thesis also focused on genetics and public policy, so my voice may sound familiar. Today I speak for myself as a genetic counselor. Genetic counselors are trained healthcare professionals who empower our patients to make informed medical decisions. I am also one of those people that draws those pedigrees that you saw up there on the screen. We are also trained to describe difficult genetic information into a language that our patients can understand and utilize. We serve as somewhat as translators of genetic information. And after trying to piece together all of these bills considering this issue, I think that I need my own personal legislative counselor. But I will try my best. So I believe the lawyer from Mayo, have some concerns about the nature of the definition of genetic information in this bill and how it will actually be implemented into our healthcare system. So I don't know what that looks like or how it would actually be done, but I think it's something that we really need to consider. As of right now, every doctor collects information on your family history, or at least they should, and if they're not, you should be asking them. And this happens at every exam, so that means that every person going to see a doctor would need to be consented. I'm wondering if this is the intent of the bill. Furthermore, DNA collected from virus testing, which is also DNA, would have similar consent as could DNA collected from someone that is being tested for Down syndrome. I would also like to note that many genetic testing companies already require informed consent to be completed on each blood sample. Thus, I see this as being in some ways repetitious. I look forward to hearing more about this piece of legislation and how it will be implemented. I am confounded by people not doing newborn screening in my specialty. I fear that families who decide not to have their children screened or not participate in research may be doing so based on misinformation or unjustified fears. In my experience, even providers' misunderstanding of genetics has been a persistent problem in our healthcare system. So I strongly agree with Representative Conn that more education needs to be done to educate not only our providers, but our families. Patients have disclosed that their doctors and nurses have told them that these diseases screened for by newborn screening are rare, and that false positives are high, and that they should not worry about the results. In cancer genetics, patients are still told that families cannot develop familial cancer from their parents' side of, or from their father's side of the family. Once again, this is false. These are instances where an individual may not be given proper information and as a consequence decide not to have their baby screened or not have important genetic tests that could greatly decrease the risk of cancer. Comments such as these lead me to believe that the reality is currently an inconsistent, uneven distribution of services and information regarding newborn screening and genetic testing. and the conversion of newborn screening to an informed consent process could lead to questionable participation rates and the potential for great harm to babies of the state of Minnesota. Patients that see genetic counselors before having a baby will receive information on newborn screening. Patients that see genetic counselors before having a baby will receive information on newborn screening, but most individuals are not seeing genetic counselors. Patients who see a genetic counselor for family history of breast cancer will have a detailed description of the risks and benefits of genetic testing, and as described earlier, will complete an informed consent that goes to that company. My ultimate goal and that of my healthcare colleagues is that everyone is educated in a consistent way and is provided appropriate information on genetic testing. A baby may appear to be healthy but could in reality develop mental retardation as a result of improper diet or have a life-threatening condition which may not present itself until later in infancy when it is too late to do anything about it. Improper assessments of family histories of breast and ovarian cancer could lead to similarly devastating consequences. In conclusion, I urge you to focus on the reality of these issues and to listen to those in the field who see what really happens to these patients and families. Genetic information does not need to be fearful, and thoughtful regulation can protect privacy rights and allow for research. Genetic information can save lives, including those of the newborn baby. As a genetic counselor, we were not originally consulted on this committee assigned to discuss the results of this bill, but we are here to share our expertise and look in the future and forward to working with you on genetic legislation. I sincerely hope for increased communication to prevent unintended and harmful consequences of bills that are created without consideration of practical implications to our healthcare system, to our health, and the health of our children. I support informed consent by genetic information and testing. I support informed consent, but genetic information and testing does not fit into a neat box and should not all be treated with the same level and need for informed consent. Should this legislation get passed and not being implemented properly, genetic healthcare providers, such as Dr. Cimenti and Mary Ann, who are with me today, are the professionals that will be handling the catastrophes and picking up the pieces of inconsistent informed consent and screening. I urge you to not let this happen. Thank you.
Thank you for coming down. That's helpful. One last testifier, Mr. Utz. Is that? I think that, I don't know if that's how it's pronounced. Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to take a few minutes today to clear the air. I've heard a lot of testimony today.
And please just state your name
Tim Utz, Columbia Heights, Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
I've heard a lot of testimony today from different people and different perspectives, but I want to just come from a perspective as a citizen of the state. I've been here 31 years in Minnesota, grew up in California, born in St. Paul. But one of the things that I don't hear a lot about is discussion is the Constitution of Minnesota and the Constitution of the federal government. Both these documents, I watched every one of the representatives in here on the first day of session. You didn't swear an oath to Mayo Clinic. You didn't swear an oath to the Department of Health. You didn't swear an oath to the citizens of the state. You all swore your allegiance to uphold this document called the Constitution. That's your priority when legislating law. In this document, the first three words are "we the people," not "we the government," not "we the state." And under the object of the government is instituted for the security, benefit, and protection of the people, in whom all political power is inherent. The power is within the people. We don't live in Russia, China, Cuba, or Germany. We live in the United States of America. We have a constitutional representative government that you are all sworn an oath to uphold. Genetic engineering data, or genetic data, is mine. Representative Kahn mentioned a lawsuit. Everybody has a liver, a kidney, or whatever. Nobody has my DNA. And there's a distinct difference between your body part and your DNA. And that wasn't addressed in the conversations that I heard about this. And it's back to the fundamental question of whose ownership. The government, you as representatives, have a privilege to represent the Constitution of the citizens. And we as citizens have the right, period, of ownership and priority in any discussion. I've been down here way too much this year watching what's going on, and I'm embarrassed as a citizen watching the process of what's going on in the Capitol. It's unconstitutional things bills being passed, bundling together, and so on and so forth.
If we could just
point is that the responsibility of this body is to follow that document, the Constitution. It's not being followed. I'm very afraid of some of the comments I've heard, is that the DNA is not the state's, and it's not Mayo Clinic's. It belongs to us, period, as the citizens, including you as citizens, when you step out of your seat here today. So thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. And we do have one other testifier that would like to speak as well. And since he's come, Mr. Mielke, I think, I'm not sure how that name is pronounced either. And then we'll be done. So thank you for coming down today.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I appreciate it. I'll be real brief.
If you could just state your name for the record as we...
Michael Mielke.
Okay.
I'm here. I'm a parent of an 18-year-old that has PKU, and he's about 1 month away from graduating from high school with top of his class. And had he not had newborn screening 18 years ago, he would be retarded today, physically and mentally retarded. And there's no history of this in my family. And I understand that we all have the rights to privacy. But my wife and I, thank God, we live in a country every day that utilizes the medical knowledge and the medical community for the better of their citizens, especially those that don't have a voice. And that's all the newborns that are going to be born in this state in the coming years. And I realize that if we provide them knowledge, but you know what? You get a young couple out there that's getting inundated with all this information. To me, if one of them opt out and a child is born and they have PKU or another genetic disease and it causes them to have retardation for their life, that's something that we can prevent. You can prevent. You know, I know there's a lot of educated people and there's always data and statistics and stuff out there, but there's a lot of voices that aren't being heard, and every time there's a poll taken, to me, it's how accurate is that data? That's what we always want to determine. How accurate is that survey or that poll? But I know there's 200 patients at the University of Minnesota in the PKU lab today, and how many of those might not have chosen the box to have the newborn screening, and their children, their lives would be altered forever because they would have no future as far as a normal life that we would consider. So I'm just here as a parent to let you know that our lives would have been completely different had it not been for newborn screening. And again, with all the information out there, a young couple, we didn't have a history in our family. Do we say yes or no? We get a lot of information about what the government's going to do with this. Again, I'm thankful that there is newborn screening. I think it's a big mistake. I think if you make it where people have to opt in, there will be people, the young couples, that will be given the wrong information or just so much information that they're inundated and they take the message wrong. They don't have their child tested, and you know, there's going to be some things that all of a sudden the dreams of that child are going to be taken away. And I thank you so much for giving me a minute.
Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you, everybody, for taking the time to do this. And I have a feeling this conversation will continue. So with that, we are adjourned.